Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour, October 3rd, 2016. Racing towards the finish line, 2016? No, this is 2019. What the heck? I had 2016 written in my notes and I just read it blindly. Okay, I got to start thinking here. I'll be doing a commentary on the Ukraine because I've said this before on my show. If I don't see the mainstream news media or the alternative news media or anybody else talking about things that I happen to know about, I will put them on this show. I don't like covering politics, but in a case like what's going on right now, I will. So I can make some commentary on that. I'm going to talk about an act in front of Congress right now. It's called the Fairness for High-Skilled Foreign Workers. And that's really interesting. I'll talk about the Elon Musk deal going on with NASA. That's kind of strange. Mass surveillance, just a heads up. And explanation, all you need to know about global warming, a commentary, and a few other things. But my main science topic, I will be talking about speccing a system, a wind system, or actually any alternative energy system, in terms of batteries. Now, I talked 2 weeks ago and I talked last week about certain aspects of batteries. I talked about last week the fact that a real alternative energy system should not have to have batteries. If it's a solution, it should not have to have batteries. You wouldn't go to, let's put it this way, you wouldn't go to your coal-burning electrical supplier, nor your nuclear power supplier, nor your natural gas power supplier, and say, you know, you can't produce enough energy for the peak times, so during off-peak times, you got to run at full capacity and store up some batteries. That's not the way you build a distribution network for electricity. You don't incorporate batteries. And so the fact that they have to incorporate batteries in what is known in the common marketplace as alternative energy is the fact that they have to include batteries means that the source of energy does not work. Okay, so I'll be talking about that as the main science topic. So continuing on how to spec a system relative to batteries. But if we go back to, say, a person that's going off-grid, can they operate without a battery pack? And the answer is yes, you can. And that's actually a very good idea. And how do you do that? Well, I'll be talking about that. I won't give you all my trade secrets. But first of all, this commentary on Ukraine. Here is the real story. And I brought this up in some detail on John Moore's show yesterday morning. But I'll fill in some of the blanks here, some of the details I didn't have time to talk about yesterday. And I'll include what I talked about yesterday in John Moore's show because this is so important. Now, let's go back, and this is all a big hubbub about a phone call that Trump made to the newly elected president of Ukraine. And that's where the glitch comes in. This is where the catch comes in. This is what everybody is up in the air about. And let's go back in history a little bit. Ukraine is one of the most fought over, envied, coveted areas in all of Eastern Europe, if not all of Europe. And it, of course, was part of the Soviet bloc. And Ukraine had traditionally been an independent country. But then it was taken into the Russian-Soviet bloc. And after the end of the Cold War with the demise of the Soviet Union, then it became somewhat independent, but then it was mustered back under Soviet control under Putin, you know, and it goes back and forth. But the Ukrainian people, there isn't a group of people on the planet that hasn't been more jacked around and screwed over than the Ukrainians. Okay, so during the Bush Jr. administration and much before, the CIA was very busy. And why? Because Ukraine holds the key to European energy, natural gas primarily, the pipelines that feed Europe with the natural gas lines that provide heating fuel for Europe during the winter comes from the Ukraine. And so Putin was controlling that. And then the CIA got in there and created what they call regime change and broke it away and took control. And so this was then also going on during the Obama administration. And that's where the people like John Kerry's son, something that nobody is talking about anymore. I don't see it in any of the news stories. They're talking about Joe Biden's kid who got thrown out of the military for cocaine, you know, finding cocaine in his whatever, and was thrown out of the military. His next job was being the board of directors of the Ukrainian energy company, where he made millions of dollars. And anyway, there are some other issues going on with China, but I'm not going to even bring that in. But Joe Biden, is, you can see the video of him talking about how he got, you know, he was going to withhold $1 billion of funding, exactly what they're accusing Trump of doing. Joe Biden did, and he even talks about it. He withheld funding for 6 hours. He said, if I go on the plane and go back to Washington in 6 hours, and you don't fire this prosecutor who is prosecuting Joe Biden's son for corruption in the Ukraine, Joe Biden says, if you don't fire this guy, you're not going to get the $1 billion. And so they fire the prosecutor, and everything goes back to normal. Hunter Biden does not get prosecuted. He continues to make millions of dollars. And the guy has no qualifications at all to be the board of directors of a energy company in Ukraine. You know, it's just absolutely ludicrous. So with that in mind, there was a firm hold by the CIA in the Ukraine. And they installed their people in there. The revolution, so to speak, was instigated, just like the CIA is trying to do in Venezuela, in other, you know, regime change places like they did in Libya. And anyway, the very long list, there's people have written up as many as 50 places that the CIA has gone in and had regime change. So a lot of the South American puppet governments, of course, that's what the big fight is over, because Ecuador elected an independent president. Bolivia elected an independent president. But other countries, actually Venezuela did, but they went in and because of the extreme wealth of Venezuela in the oil industry, they went in and tried to do a coup. Okay, so anyway, back to the Ukraine. So during the Obama years, the Ukraine was nestled firmly under the directorship of the CIA. And just remember that the CIA has nothing to do with the United States. It is an independent organization, and literally the CIA has controlled the president's office since they, probably before, but certainly since they killed John Kennedy. The presidential office has been strictly managed from the Central Intelligence Agency. Okay, and so thus in Ukraine, as with one of many puppet governments around the world installed by the CIA, it was nestled firmly under the control of what you call the deep state, which works hand in hand, glove in hand with the CIA. Okay, so all of this was a cozy deal until Trump got elected. Now, the last thing that happened in this situation is the election in Ukraine recently, where a Trump-like president was elected, populist with the people. He was elected on getting rid of corruption and ousting basically the CIA from the massive corruption that had gone on for decades in Ukraine. And so anyway, Trump was calling him and congratulating him. And the last people on the planet that the deep state and the CIA want talking is Trump and the newly elected president of Ukraine, both of them seeking to rout out the decades of corruption. And of course, Biden was vice president under Obama, and he was flying around cutting these $1 billion deals in foreign countries that, you know, basically regime change and regime monitoring. And now their cozy relationship is going under and they can't stand it. So they're going ballistic. They're doing everything they can to get so that Trump cannot talk to this president, because they know that Ukraine holds a lot of information relative to the 2016 election, where there was Russian oligarchs working to fund Hillary Clinton out of the Ukraine. And that's just one of the mechanisms where the money was moved to try and defeat Donald Trump. So end result is that the Democrats, the nutcases, the Schiffs and the Nadlers and the Pelosis and on, are just, they have handlers. They have people who are managing them. And end result is that they're going all out on an impeachment witch hunt. And that's what it's all about, because they cannot, absolutely cannot let real investigations go on into the decades of dirty dealings of the CIA and the Ukraine. And that's what this new president said he was going to do. He was going to unearth it and do investigations. And all Trump was saying was, by the way, you've got the servers over there that were related to the 2016 meddling in the election, where Hillary Clinton paid for the dossier through Christopher Steele, through London, and it passed through and then eventually the U.S. press published that. Completely fake news, saying all kinds of derogatory things about Trump, none of which turned out to be true. But that was right in the September-October timeframe prior to the 2016 election, trying to influence the people from voting for Trump. Okay, so anyway, that's the story. The deep state, which is working hand in glove with the CIA, cannot stand the concept of Trump dealing with the new president of the Ukraine to rout out the corruption that the CIA and the deep state had been involved in for, like I say, decades, in corruption in the energy industry, in the food industry, in the Ukraine. So that's what it's all about. It's pure and simple. There's no other explanation. And I haven't had time to listen to all the other alternative sources out there. Usually Alex Jones is pretty spot on with his analysis, but I have not listened to him. I haven't had time, and I have not listened to really anybody else. I've been so busy with stuff I've been doing. So I don't know if they've hit on this, but I know the major news medias, like, for example, Fox, have not hit on this particular aspect, which is the core issue with the Ukraine story. Okay, so I'm not going to spend any more time on that, other than I'm going to give this my three-week rule, that if it's still around, if it's still a story in 3 weeks, I will possibly do some more analysis on it. If the mainstream media and if the alternative mainstream media has not picked up on the core issues. Okay, next I want to talk about a video a listener sent to me. It's the name of it is it's on a Patreon channel, and I forget the guy's names, but I believe the name of the video is NASA Going Nowhere. And when it starts out, the guy talks about things, literally everything that I've been saying for decades, that NASA is a front agency, and it's Congress proof that any senator would be political suicide to vote against a NASA appropriation, and Trump is very well aware of this, etc. So they all give NASA everything at once. But this guy did some very interesting things. He went back to Eisenhower, and he analyzed every presidential input into space programs, where NASA was actually started by Eisenhower. It was then handed off to John Kennedy, who promised that we were going to go to the moon by the end of the 1960s. And then there were some very interesting conversations in there, but with James Webb, the current, the then head of NASA, basically saying that they couldn't do it, that there was no way that NASA could go to the moon. And they said they don't know what the surface of the moon looks like. And that's one of my pet peeves, too, is the only visible, you know, visibility that we have, or alleged visibility of the moon's surface, is like a warehouse with a kind of an uneven surface with a quarter inch of dust on it. And that's supposedly what the moon's surface is like. And it's like, no, no, that's not what the moon's surface is like at all. It couldn't possibly be like that. But anyway, that neither here nor there. But the point of this video, this titled NASA Going Nowhere, is that all of the money that's been spent on NASA, and I talk about this also, humongous amounts of money, not only on NASA, but on the space program, the private space programs, etc., where the author of this video shows that the space as an industry has made more money than Hollywood, music industry, and video game industry combined. So the big money, is in the aerospace industry. And of course, well, anyway, that's all I'm going to say. It's a good video to watch. And, okay, the next topic, there's a bill, it's called S-386. And I believe it's in the House. It's called Fairness for High-Skilled Foreign Workers. And here's what it is. They want to lift the quotas, in other words, the limiting numbers of visas for high-tech workers, mainly coming from India. Now, I have friends that work in the high-tech industries, and they you know, they say that it's like working in a foreign country, that they work with Chinese people. These are people up in Belmont, Washington, and down the coast through the Silicon Valley, etc. And they just said that, you know, they feel like they're living in a foreign country. Housing is extremely expensive because of the high salaries, property values going up, and therefore they, but then everybody is a contractor. Everybody is a contractor, meaning you don't have a wage, you don't have benefits, you're not an employee, you can be axed on a given notice, and you're working for relatively low pay because next to you are people from India or China that work for relatively low pay and for those conditions where they're not employees. And so anyway, this bill S-386, that's called Fairness for High-Skilled Foreign Workers. Well, it's not fair for American workers who basically just want a job. They're highly skilled workers, and they're competing against, it would be like if they legalized immigrants in any other sector and then took jobs away from American citizens, basically invading an industry, taking the jobs, and squeezing out American workers. And this is coming direct from the people in Congress. They're voting for this, or at least proposing it. People out there better wake up and find out what's going on, because your kids are going to grow up into a world where the only kind of job they're going to be able to get with an advanced degree is a contractor job that is temporary with no benefits. And you know, basically, how can you raise a family? How can you buy a house? How can you create a future when the only thing you know is the next paycheck you're going to get is the only guarantee that you have? You don't even have a benefit of knowing that in 2 weeks or in 4 weeks you're going to have a paycheck. And you're just expendable. You're not a real commodity in terms of being an employee. Interesting other story is NASA, head of NASA, is telling Elon Musk to get his act together and come through with the fulfill the contracts for about 10 years. Musk and Boeing are the two leading contractors to build carrier vehicles to take people into outer space. Musk, even though he has talked about going to the moon and Mars, has a corporate directive of only going into low Earth orbit. And that's very interesting. I also saw a quip the other day where Musk claimed that there's no evidence of aliens. And I just thought, well, gee, now all of a sudden Elon Musk is an expert on aliens? That's a stretch. How did he become an expert? Anyway, that's a whole nother story in itself. But the end response is Musk is pushing his new space vehicle, looks like a Flash Gordon rocket, so that they can take payloads into low Earth orbit. Alex Jones did somebody sent this in. Alex Jones has been doing a lot of work on mass surveillance. So I'll just give you a heads up. It's something I'm not going to particularly cover. There was a point at which I began a program or a project to have it publicly funded in one of the public funding engines. And it really never got off the ground. It was called Windroids 11 OS. I'm sorry. And so it was like a step up from Windows 10 and a step up from Android. And the idea was that it would look and act like Windows and Android, whichever you chose for your smartphone. But it would put you in control. It would take out the hacking hooks that are in there so that everybody owns all your information. At the same time I was doing that, the telephone companies dropped the surveillance hooks down into the hardware, into the telephone, so the operating system runs above that and cannot then delimit or remove the hacking capability that's in the hardware layer, in the telephones, in the smartphones. So anyway, that's something that was the last stage. That was before 4G came in. And then all of a sudden now 5G is coming in. And the level of surveillance is just unbelievable. But if you go to countries like China, they're beginning to accept it, that they will have social scores, etc. And so anyway, I encourage you to follow that. That's not a topic I'm going to be talking a lot about, but just be aware that there are people covering that topic. Here's a thing that the only thing you have to know about global warming. There's only one fact that you have to know. There's only one argument that should even be made about so-called global warming or climate change or whatever you want to talk about. It turns out that in any heat engine, that's the main source of energy today, if you're looking at coal, nuclear, natural gas, or petroleum, which creates either energy for cruise ships or big ships, or certain power plants, especially on islands, they use fuel oil, refined fuel oil or number two fuel oil, to create electricity. But the majority of electricity in the world is created from the big three: coal, nuclear, and natural gas. And all you have to know, the only thing you have to know about global warming, is that in all of those heat engines, that's what they are. And let me just explain what I mean by that, if you're not an expert in thermodynamics. Heat engine uses what is known as the Carnot cycle. You heat something up, like a liquid or steam, and then you extract energy from that medium. You can extract a certain amount of energy, and then you take that, for example, in the case of steam, it cools down, creates water again, and then you move it back into the vaporization stage. When it expands into steam, it drives an engine, which then drives a generator, which creates electricity. But that entire process, once you take out the inefficiencies, if it were a perfectly efficient process, following the Carnot cycle, C-A-R-N-O-T, Carnot cycle, something that's understood in thermodynamics, the maximum limit of energy you can get out of a heat system is around 33%. And the energy companies like to talk about being very close to that, but in reality, after you talk about the distribution, the every other form of loss of electricity, they're around 20% efficient. In other words, 80% of the energy is lost into heat going directly into the atmosphere right now. So how can you complain about a little bit of alleged greenhouse effect that's going to happen in 20 years from the little bit of carbon dioxide that's coming out of a chimney or exhaust pipe of an automobile or bus, etc.? How can you complain about that and ignore the fact that 80% of the heat that's being created to move the car, the bus, to create the electricity at the central power company, 80% of that heat is going directly into the atmosphere right now. Eventually, that other 20%, which actually does useful work, running electric motors, running your toaster, washing your clothes, running a refrigerator, you know, charging your electric car, that other 20% is very inefficient. And ultimately, by the time the energy gets used, most of that is going to end up as heat in the atmosphere also. So trying to make an argument that in 20 years, the temperature of the Earth is going to raise by a certain amount, like a 0.01 degree or something, because of greenhouse gases is absolutely ludicrous when 100% of that energy is going directly into the atmosphere as heat today. Today, not tomorrow, not a week, not 20 years, but the second it's burned. And so I was in a parking lot the other day getting out of my car, and there was a big van parked next to me, and it had all the windows closed, and it was obviously running their air conditioner. But that engine was throwing out some serious, serious heat right there. And I thought, you know, how can people not notice this? And this has been observed and talked about by other people, but it's just kept completely out of any mainstream media or any alternative media. Nobody talks about this little fun fact that 80%, let me give you some perspective. In fact, I have a video on my webpage that talks about this. It's you can scroll all the way down to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Very close to the bottom, there's a coal train. And it's a little video. It's a couple minutes long. And I talk about the fact that if you take 100 cars of that coal train, 100 cars, 20 of them are going to end up doing useful work. The other 80 cars, because of the Carnot cycle, because of the maximum limit of a heat engine to produce useful work, and also the inefficiencies that are in the system, 80 of those coal train cars are going to simply create heat that goes directly into the atmosphere. This is insane. This is insane. This is what they're selling you for energy. But this is the only thing you have to know about global climate change or global warming. It's the only thing you have to know. You don't have to have PhDs lined up on one side making arguments. You don't need PhDs on the other side with all their credentials stating, well, this guy's got a PhD from here or there or whatever. You don't need any of that. Any third grader, including that, what's her name, Thunberg, or the child that they have in the UN pumping the idea of global climate change. And by the way, I liked Putin's response to that whole thing. He said the use of children to further political means should be condemned. He said, I'm not impressed with any of it. And that's a paraphrase, but it was something like that. And I agree with him. political agendas, political movements should not use kids. In fact, you might all go all the way back to the Children's Crusade back in the Middle Ages, where the kids all got together and they marched off to the Holy Land to take it back, and most of them died. Yeah. So that was another example of using kids for a political agenda. That's a real good example. Or how about the Pied Piper? Yeah, kids are not good at making decisions, especially when they've been fed mass hysteria. A friend of mine was telling me that back in the, let me see, this would have been about 25 years ago in school. This kid was a high school student, and they told him that there was imminent global freezing. There was going to be an ice age, and everybody was going to die. There wouldn't be any food. And this is what this kid grew up believing, until he finally realized the time went and came and went, and he realized that he had been lied to. But he went home from school every night worried that the world was going to end due to another ice age. And, of course, it didn't happen. Now there's people predicting the same thing. I don't make predictions. I don't make climate predictions. I don't make weather predictions. I don't make predictions of when some celestial object might come into the solar system. I don't make predictions unless I have actual data that would suggest it. And there is no data, real data. And let me, I went through a whole show on this whole global climate change thing. But, and I went through a whole laundry list of all of the topics, so I'm not going to repeat it here. But the end result is, the only thing you have to know is that right now 80% of the heat being generated in nuclear, coal, gas, bus engines, electric power stations, automobiles, or whatever, 80% of that heat is going into the atmosphere right now. And nobody says a word about it. Okay. On to the next topic. And here's another fun fact that came out in the news, that in the next 20 years, 720,000 tons of three-blade wind turbine blades are going to have to be recycled. And they're so big, they don't fit in a landfill. They're odd-shaped, and there's no way to cut them up. They're not biodegradable. And there's no way to cut these things up. It's not profitable. In fact, it's a great expense to take these things down. And so the end result, just imagine that. And that's just the three-blade wind turbine blades. That has nothing to do with all the other hardware or the steel or the cement. Cement is not very recyclable, really. The bases and the towers, etc., for the three-blade wind turbines are tremendous environmental impact, just trying to get rid of these things. The same thing is happening with solar panels. They're now discovering that those solar panels sitting out in the desert or wherever they are leaching doping materials, it's called, when they make the semiconductors that make up the solar panels, that doping material is leaching into the ground because of rain, because of sun bleaching the solar panels. And so by the time their lifetime is done, it's killing the insects, it's killing the ecosystem that lived on that area. So now what they want to do is they want to pave vast areas of the planet with solar panels, which only have at most a 10-year lifespan, and then they're going to have to be recycled. So there's, I've said this on the air. I said, if you want to start a good business, something that I'm not interested in doing, but if you want a good business, go into the solar panel recycling business, because there's going to be a lot of work for you in the next 10 years. You're going to have millions and millions of those things coming in that they have to get rid of. And there's really no good way to get rid of them. There's some other topics I wanted to talk about, but just a quick notice. On previous shows, I think the last 2 weeks, I talked about my water filter products. And then I had a program set up that if you sent me your zip code, I would send you a study. Basically, now I've added something to that. If you send me your zip code, I also need your water supplier company. And so go on your water your water bill that you pay every month. Go on your water bill and look at who your supplier is. So what I need is your zip code and the water supplier for your house water bill. And with that, I can tunnel in to the databases that are available that have been built over the last probably 5 to 8 years on the pollution that's in these water systems. So once again, just go to my webpage. There's an email address at the very top. It's the jmcc@jmcanniescience.com email address. Spelled out correctly there, so go to my webpage. And send me your zip code, your water supplier, utility company, and I'll send you back a report. And, of course, the idea is for people to understand that the so-called government standards are not valid. They're very minimal, and in a lot of cases, the cities and municipalities are faking them just to comply with the standards. But a city will say, and the EPA, the federal EPA, will say, oh, well, this city is federally compliant. But what you're going to find out is there are cities with 20 or 30 carcinogenic chemicals in their water that are above nationally established health limits for that particular chemical or pollutant, but they're not included in the federal standards. So anyway, that's very important. And here's the issue. I'm interested in focusing on whole house water filters. The reason being is then you take out the pollutants before they get into your piping in the house. And also, the biggest cause, the increase in cause of cancer in the United States is due to pollution in the water. And you get into the shower. Here's the problem. You get into the shower, you shower with carcinogenic chemicals in the water. They vaporize, you breathe it in. It's hot water, so it goes through your skin readily. And within 5-10 years, can start to cause cancer. So anyway, that's why, and if you just start looking at your entire family's health, long-term health, etc., the whole house water filter is really a bargain. My water filters are on sale right now for 10 to 15% off, depending on the model, free shipping to the 48 states, etc. Okay, so a little bit of an advertisement there, but this is a good program where I can send you information about the testing of your water. These federally supported tests have now been compiled, and I have a way to get into the databases where I can take your zip code, your water field, your water supplier, utility company, and I can tell you what is in your water. Okay, so now talking about specking out a system. And okay, I'm going to go to kind of an extreme system here to just give you an example. This is an actual real example of somebody that's trying to spec out a wing generator system. And so first thing is we have to look at the location. And by the way, let me preface this by saying I, of course, I'm very familiar with my competition, if I even call it that. There's really nobody that has any product that's anywhere close or even remotely close to what I'm doing with the wing generator. But anything that's on the market is a one-size-fits-all. You buy it, you set it up, that's what it is. If it works, good. If it doesn't, good too. That's the attitude, basically, because the... But here's the technical situation. Okay, say you live in central Iowa. and you have a fairly good wind sometimes in the year, and then sometimes you don't have much wind at all. Okay, can you have a wind system? Well, yeah, but you have to make the wing much bigger. You have to capture more energy or energy from a larger physical area with the wing generator, and so therefore the cost of the system for that person is much more than a person that lives in Nantucket, where the wind is ripping through there like crazy, or say in Nevada, there are some valleys out there where the wind just comes ripping down there all the time, and they could not have a wing system that big on a particular generator. And this is talking about, say, the same generator, let's say, for example, 10 kilowatt generator. So the wing system itself that goes on a 10 kilowatt generator is going to be very different depending on the wind and wind conditions. So that's number one. Number two, what kind of wind obstructions are in the vicinity of where this wing generator is going to go? Okay, if you have a tree line, if you have a forest, if you have hills, if you have farm buildings, if you have even a hedgerow 200 feet away, that could make, in the direction where the wind typically comes from in the United States is typically coming from the west or southwest. Okay, so any of those factors can affect where you want to place the wing generator. And so if you have to get it above some of these wind obstructions, then you have the issue of the tower. Okay, so now you have something, and maybe a tower for one person that has very good wind, and this is still talking about, just say, for example, a 10-kilowatt system. Some person that has very good wind and no obstructions at all, say they're right on the coastline, and they have very good wind coming off the lake or the ocean or whatever, the body of water that they're near. They have very good wind coming in all the time. There's no obstructions. So they can have a tower that's relatively short. Yet a person that, say, has a farm out in the plains of the United States, and that's very flat, okay, maybe you have to get up to 25 or 30 feet in the air. Yeah, but maybe there's somebody that has a hill, but there's a woods 200 yards away on another hill. Okay, so the question is, you have to get in a location or get the wing generator up high enough where it's not affected. The run of wind is not affected by local conditions, trees, barns, tree lines, bushes that are relatively close, all kinds of other factors. And so you can see that just in the very beginning, this is not a one-size-fits-all. So any company that's selling one-size-fits-all is not selling a legitimate product. Okay, so now I want to take this to the, because I've been talking about batteries, I want to take this to the concept of batteries. Now, I just had a guy that was interested in wing generators, and I'm talking to him, and he said, I think that the 10 kilowatt will be enough. But then when we looked at his well pump, it turns out that the well pump is a pretty big pump, and it's a three-phase pump, which is typical of wells, and it had a surge current that was in excess of 10 kilowatts. And so he could run his well pump on a 10-kilowatt inverter, but the problem is when you turn that pump on, the inverter, it's going to surge over the limit of the inverter. And so that the issue is that then the inverter would turn off, and so it would not be a good match. So you have to add an inverter that is bigger than 10 kilowatts. So do you see how this is particular thing, designing a system, whereas a person that uses less energy than a 10 kilowatt system and does not have three-phase motors to deal with, maybe he's using small tools that don't have big surge currents, he can get away with a 10 kilowatt inverter and say a one deep battery pack, and is, say that person is happy working when there is wind. When there is wind, he can get enough energy, and then the battery pack lasts for maybe an hour or so to power his shop, his particular metal shop or woodworking shop, and he's happy with that. But then there's the other person that wants to run 24/7. Well, batteries are expensive, no matter how you cut it. They have to be replaced occasionally, and they're also big. They're bulky. They take up a good deal of room. And because my systems are high voltage, then you have a significant investment in batteries. But there is a way to get around having a lot of batteries and still provide the person with energy 24/7. So there's ways to design these systems. So I just wanted to mention this because this is a little closer to home for most people dealing with an electric generation system that's off-grid or on-grid or something like that. But I tend to, when especially the smaller systems, it's much better for the person to simply go off-grid. But now let's look at a national-scale electrical generation system. And here's where the actual problem comes in. And I talked about this last week, that the batteries on a national scale are extremely expensive. Not only expensive, but they're actually dangerous. When you have that much battery backup, and batteries tend to be relatively low voltage, therefore, if they're low voltage, they're high current. High current means that if one little connection fails, then you can have a spark point where that connection burns and fails, and then all of a sudden you have a short circuit, and potentially that's what can cause a fire. When a lot of current is moving through a point where there's a bad connection, that current is wants to move through that connection. And so that's what's going on with the Walmart stores that are burning down, etc. Solar typically is a low voltage, and I'm talking about relatively low voltage system. And so when you're dealing with power levels, enough power to power a Walmart store with all the refrigeration and lighting and cash registers, everything else that is going on in a Walmart store, that's a significant amount of power. And so especially what they were doing there is they were putting solar panels, which only provide a energy during a certain part of the day. And so if you want more energy, then you have to store it up in batteries, and those battery banks can become fairly significant. And typically, none of those installations were 100% off the grid. They were connected into the grid. But still, the end result was a fire. Because just the basics of how these systems are designed, low voltage, big arrays, a lot of high current, and a lot of failure points. It makes for a very bad system. Something that's has a lot of when you let's just explain this a little bit. When you have a failure point, say that you're a say you're an engineer designing a spaceship for NASA to go to the moon. Okay. And your engineers are trying to determine what is the probability that this system, which is made up of thousands of parts, thousands of electrical circuits, and thousands of failure points, what is the probability that this thing is going to last and work properly for the next, once it's launched, for the next 2 weeks. And so you have to have all of the parts with a lifetime that far exceeds 2 weeks. And so if you have one part in there that has a lifetime of 2 weeks, then you would say that the failure point is going to be 2 weeks. Now, if you have 100 parts in there that have a failure point of 2 weeks, now you start getting down to the point where the failure, the mean time between failure, might be a couple hours. And that's the same with a large solar array. If you have thousands of solar panels, low voltage, high current, then you have the potential for failures within a relatively short amount of time. And that's what's happening. This is simply design engineering, something I happen to be very familiar with, something I spend a good portion of my life working in. And all of those years, by the way, people that have followed me for decades, and I had actually, you know, real jobs working in telecommunications industry, about 10 of those years designing highly secure telecommunications computers, dealing with encryption, telecommunications, encoding, etc. I was in both the hardware design and software design, mainly the hardware design, and was very high level in that industry. I was not a programmer. I was not a circuit designer. I was basically a systems engineer was my title, principal systems engineer. I was a senior systems engineer for a long time and then graduated to principal systems engineer, writing specifications for electrical circuits, technical specifications for instruction sets for custom chips, for memories, for communications within the computers themselves, communication buses, timing, all of that. And so the understanding the failure points was something that I had to do. That was part of my job. And so I understand about such things. And so when it comes to designing an alternative energy system, the same principles apply. That your mean time between failure for an individual component has to be long compared to the expected lifetime of the system. So for a solar system, a solar array system to last 10 years, you need the mean time between failure to be maybe 1,000 years on the connectors. And if your connectors have never been tested for 1,000 years or in a laboratory environment, in a test environment to simulate that length of time, then you really don't have any reliable data that would say that this thing is going to last. And what we're finding out is that exactly what I'm saying. If you have low voltage and that implies, I mean, that's just Ohm's law. If you have, if you're going to get a lot of power out of this system with low voltage, you have to have a very high current level, and the high current then creates failure points, many more failure points than you would have normally on a high voltage, low current system. So that's when, for example, when I designed the wing generator, in my functional specification for the wing generator, I said that the voltage had to be high voltage, and it had to be low current. And so in the, for example, the 50 kilowatt wing generator, since it's high voltage, the wires we're using are like 8 gauge wire, very small diameter wire. And that's carrying all of that power, 50 kilowatts of power, in a very small gauge wire, and it can run up to hundreds, if not thousands, of feet in the distribution line. And it's also alternating, a very high voltage alternating three-phase current comes out of the generator heads. So at any rate, I knew these things. And so the failure point on a high voltage, low current circuit is much more forgiving than a low voltage, high current circuit that they're using in solar panels. So it just gives you an idea of the amount of design work that goes into designing a particular system. Okay, so then when I go to somebody's particular farm or ranch and try to spec out a system, there's a lot of detail that goes into understanding what kind of equipment they're going to be running, the number of hours per day. Do they want this to be 24/7 power? Do they want to just a grid assist where they're actually plugging into the grid and supplying energy into the grid? Or do they want to be completely off grid? Or do they want a system that where they can be autonomous if the grid goes down? Because a simple grid connect system, if the grid goes down, you don't have any power, because the for solar or even for wind, if it's not designed properly, then your only capability is to put energy out onto the grid. You don't have any ability to run your local setup, because what you're doing is you're feeding energy into the grid and then getting a credit for it. And then really the grid, the central power company, is supplying you with energy. That's the way a grid connect works. And so people who want to be truly off grid then have to have a system that actually will operate, provide the entire load of electricity 24/7, 365 days a year, without any interruption. Because if, say, you have a cattle farm, you have a milking operation, when those cows come in to be milked, those machines better be running. You have 200 head of cattle standing there with full of milk, and you can't get the milk out, you got a problem. And so the designs are critical. If you're going to be off grid, if you're going to be on grid and your system fails, it's not too big a problem, because you're just losing some money generation. If you have an off-grid system and you have 200 cows standing there and the machines are not working, then you have a problem. And so there has to be a way to back that up. Do you want to then have batteries, enough batteries to back up that amount of energy? Actually, there's a better way to do it. And so the first thing you need, however, is an energy generation system that works, that can provide more than 100% of your energy needs. Okay, so anyway, once again, a little bit of background on the wing generator and the engineering that goes into designing systems. And so I'm talking about this because every now and then somebody comes up and says, well, what does one of those systems cost? And I say, well, it depends. And they say, what do you mean it depends? Well, it depends on all kinds of factors. I just described to you a number of them. And, for example, the tower can vary greatly in price. The size of the wing, if you're in a low wind area, a much larger wing to gather the same amount of energy can cost a lot more also. So these are factors that go into designing a system for a particular person, and it's not a one-size-fits-all. Okay, once again, I've asked my listeners to help support me by buying my water filter products. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. I've got the greatest water filter products on the planet. No add-on filters required. Free shipping to the 48 states. And products are on sale, 15% off on water filter products. Bulk sale pricing on the filter elements. And the whole house water filters on sale. And if you buy the replacement filter packs with the main unit, you get a big savings. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.